Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to all our listeners in Bristol and also listeners in Preston on Preston FM 103.2 and also to our listeners on Radio Verulam in St Albans. We've got a theme this week and it's fair trade. Our guests this week are Vivian Kinston, who has visited many fair trade producers in Africa, and we've also got Rod Stone from the organisation Tools for Self-Reliance. Brian Kenaway, author of Tradition Betrayed, talks to Dialect's Anthea Page about the Orange Order and the Bill of Rights. Alec Milne continues with more of the selected letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, and Tim is with us for a poem. Jeff has his usual What's On Guide, and Julian Parry, unfortunately, is not able to be with us this week, but hopefully he'll be back soon. I'm John Peters Coleman. But first, to start the show, let's have a bit of John Lennon and Power to the People. That was Power to the People by John Lennon, and that served as an introduction of sorts to our first guest, Vivian Kinston. Hello.
Hello, John. Really good to be here.
Thank you. Well, you're associated with Fair Trade, but yeah. What is your association with them?
Well, I don't live in Bristol. I live in Bradford-on-Avon, and we were one of the first towns in England to become a Fair Trade town. Now, the idea of Fair Trade towns took off because a few people in Garstang in Lancashire decided to make their town a fair trade town by having as many people as possible using fair trade products. And from there, it just spread like wildfire because a lot of people thought it was a very inspiring idea and a way of promoting fair trade and bringing people in a town together.
Okay, so is Bristol fair trade?
Bristol is a fair trade city, has okay. been since, I think, 2005, probably one of the leading fair trade cities in the world. And it's got its own, to keep a fair trade town status going, you have to have a network of committed people working on increasing the fair trade market. Jenny Foster heads up the Bristol Fair Trade Network.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I hope.
And you're a representative of the Bradford Network.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. So, how long has fair trade been going?
I'll tell a quick story about it. It started in the late 1980s when coffee prices went through the floor and Central American coffee producers were really suffering. And the first brand of coffee on fair trade principles, where the producers got a guaranteed minimum price and a premium, was put on the market. Anybody who was around in those days will remember it because it was horrible. It was really not good.
In terms of the taste of it.
I bought it because I thought, you know, the concept is brilliant, but yeah. I couldn't get anybody to drink in my family to drink it. Things have changed so much since then, and fair trade is now associated with top flavours, top tastes, a whole range of brands from, you know, from expensive luxury to supermarket-owned brands have adopted fair trade.
Now, a lot of people in Bristol might not have any idea that we're a fair trade city because people just sort of go to the supermarkets as per usual. So what does it actually mean?
It means that the council has signed up to support fair trade, which Bristol Council does through its procurement. In other words, all the it favours fair trades in all the things that the council buys, which is a really good way of doing it. And it's got a network of active, committed people keeping it going.
Okay. What do you do to sort of outreach to sort of members of the public?
Well, the big event of the year has just finished, and that's Fair Trade Fortnight, which finished last Sunday. It's always end of February, beginning of March. And that's when all the fair trade supporters all over the country put on any events they can to just to publicise and catch people's attention. The theme this year was cotton. Fair trade cotton came on the market about 5 years ago. It's really established itself. You can get it in lots of specialist clothes retailers, also Marks and Spencer, Sainsbury's, other places. So that was the theme. The other theme was being proud of what we do, really shouting aloud, you know, about fair trade.
Okay. I suppose the biggest put-off for a lot of people in terms of fair trade, in fact, the only one probably, is the expense. I mean, do fair trade products cost more?
The answer to that is yes and no. At one time, it was a definite yes. And if you think about it, the whole point of fair trade is that the farmers in poor countries get a guaranteed minimum price, which means that they can survive fluctuations in the world price, they can invest for the future, and they also get a small premium to decide as a cooperative, because they're all formed into cooperatives, as a cooperative what they spend it on, which is often investing in their farms like barns, drying sheds. It can be schools, it can be buses, it can be bringing electricity to the village. However, I mean, nothing comes without a cost. So it is reasonable to expect fair trade products to be a bit more expensive. And remarkably, to some people, we've been proved that once people understand the concept, they want to buy it. What's changed in the last few years is that fair trade has spread enormously. It's growing something like 40% a year in this country. Supermarkets have come on board. And the reason they've done that is really because thousands, millions of people like us said, why don't you sell more fair trade? Where's the fair trade? We want to see fair trade. And from supermarkets being involved, prices have come down, and often, you know, if you look for the right brand, it's comparable with anything else. Right.
To what extent can consumers sort of feedback and comment on fair trade policy? And to what extent can they sort of take up what people are saying and think, well, okay, we might sort of change some of our ideas or add new ideas?
You mean in terms of influencing shops or in terms of influencing somebody?
Fair trade and what policies it has.
Right. At the end of the programme, I'll give you the website for the Fair Trade Foundation so anybody can contact them with suggestions. And the best way, really, of having influence is to join your local group and, you know, meet like-minded people, you know, and together, you know, you've got an influence, you can feed ideas.
So it's quite a strong sort of grassroots movement element to it.
It's grown through grassroots people. It absolutely has, like people taking up the idea of fair trade towns and running with it and making it happen. This year, it's the fair trade mark, the colourful logo, which you see on products, is basically run by the Fair Trade Foundation in London, and it's part of an international labelling, fair trade labelling organisations. But they're about 100 in the UK, there are about 100 people working in London. And what's really made it grow is thousands, millions of people all over the country just doing it because they believe in it.
So what sign have you seen personally about how it's benefiting people in poor countries?
I'll start with the most recent, because during Fair Trade Fortnight, we were very lucky this year that we had a visit in Wiltshire from a banana farmer from St. Vincent in the Windward Islands,
okay,
who was such an interesting man to meet and talk to. And him talking about his cooperative of banana farmers on a tiny little island, and an island that was devastated by a hurricane at the end of last year, was just fascinating and inspiring, and he could bring it to life, all the way from planting the banana seedlings, harvesting the crop, getting it to the port, getting it to England, and the whole story. And particularly in the aftermath of the hurricane, the fair trade premium, the sort of 1% extra that they get, is actually what they're surviving on until the new crop's ready, which won't be for about 4 or 5 months yet.
Right.
Lots of first-hand experiences. I've also been lucky to be able to go on holidays. I mean, nobody paid for me to go, but Tradecraft, one of the big fair trade organisations, runs trips where you have a holiday and meet fair trade producers. So I've met people in South Africa and Malawi and Zambia, a real great range of people. South Africa was nice because of the wine.
Yes. Well, it's always got to be a good point too, surely, yeah.
Yeah.
So what was the difference in real terms between the life they could have had, you know, without the fair trade organisation, yeah, and life with it?
Well, I do have to say it's not making anybody rich. That, you know, these are still poor countries where the money people can earn is low. But people who are part of a licensed fair trade producer group do have, it's the guaranteed minimum price. For instance, if you're growing coffee, which is one of the big fair trade staples,
yeah,
it takes at least 3 years for a coffee bush to start producing. So you need to have some guarantee that you've got a market there and the price isn't going to go through the floor. And that's what fair trade does. People can plan for the future. One of the requirements is that they work together as a cooperative, that everybody has an equal voice and decisions are made cooperatively. There are also environmental standards which people have to adhere to, and the banana farmer from St. Vincent, you know, made that very clear. They used, before fair trade, they used to use a lot of sprays and pesticides on the crop. Now they don't.
Okay.
They have to be much more responsible farmers.
We start to wind up now. I mean, what's if people want to find out more, particularly if people are downloading this show, what websites are that people can visit? I understand you've got like a national one.
Yeah.
And one that's,
okay,
more local.
www.fairtrade.org.uk.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to know more about Bristol, which I'm sure you will, it's www.bristolfairtrade.org.uk.
Okay.
And for other parts of the Southwest, southwestfairtrade.org.uk.
Okay, well, if you put any or all of those into your web browser or the actual address, if you can write that down or remember it, then you'll be able to find out more. Vivian Kinniston, thank you very much for coming in. It's been a pleasure. So time for second guest, along a sort of a similar theme, slightly charitable, our second guest, Rod Stone from Tools for Self-Reliance.
Hi, John.
So tell me a little bit about Tools for Self-Reliance. How long has that been going?
Tools for Self-Reliance started up in the late 70s and it became a full-time charity in 1979. So it's been going for just over 30 years. It started up in Southampton with a guy who worked in the Portsmouth Polytechnic, and he went out to Uganda. And to cut a long story short, he eventually ended up collecting local tools and using the students from the Portsmouth Polytechnic to collect local tools. And they put them together in the forms of a block of kits for carpenters, that sort of thing. And they managed to get them sent out by a grant from UNESCO. So that was the first part of it. But eventually, from there, they've built up a big organisation and there are now just over 60 groups in the country, Bristol being one of them, and we operate, you know, in that respect.
Okay. How long have you, when did you first find out about them?
I found out about them in 2000. I retired then, and I had a load of plumber's tools given me by a friend of mine. As I had my own plumber's tools, I didn't need them. So I remembered somewhere that a charity in existence for taking tools and sending them to Africa. So I rang the Citizens Advice Bureau, and they gave me the headquarters of Tools for Self-Reliance down near Southampton. The guy there said, well, there is a collector in Bristol, but there's no group. So I took the tools to the collector, and he persuaded me that we ought to start a group together. So the two of us, a guy called Morris Weeks and myself, we managed to find some premises in Kingswood Museum in Warmley, and we started up the group from there. And that was in 2002, we sent our first kit down to Southampton.
Okay, how many members have you got in your group now?
We've got 12 members, that's 8 men and 4 women. And the 4 of the members look after the sewing machine side, and the remaining 8 members look after the tools side, because we do send sewing machines as well as tools.
Okay. Well, what sort of countries do you send them to then?
We send them to countries in Africa. We go to Uganda, Tanzania, Ghana, Sierra Leone, Malawi, Mozambique, and in past years we have sent very, very rarely to Zimbabwe, but that's now stopped. So it's currently about 7 African countries.
Okay. How do you actually connect with these people in these various countries? What do you do?
Right. Well, I'll take, for example, Tanzania. There's an organisation in Tanzania called SIDO, which is SIDO, Small Industries Development Organisation, and they are our partner group in Tanzania. And our headquarters, as I say, near Southampton, they liaise with SIDO, and SIDO will tell them who out there wants the tools and what sort of tools they want. In the past, it was just a case of sending the tools to them, but now we get more and more involved with training the people in these countries to make sure they can operate the tools and sewing machines properly. And also, in the last couple of years, the development of their businesses. So they're given basic training in things like bookkeeping, how much to charge for their work, and the cost of the sort of things like materials and that sort of thing. So it's not just sending out tools to Africa. It's a little bit more than that now.
Okay. How do you go about raising funds?
The funds for our local group in Bristol is a very local affair, and for tools we don't send, for example, in a lot of cases, we don't send complex electrical stuff which we're given, because a lot of these African countries and the villages they go to have no power at all.
Right.
So they don't want electrical equipment. So we will sell that on eBay or at a car boot. So we get our funds that way. The main headquarters, they're on a different system, and they get funding from the large organisations in the country.
Okay. Have you found the recession? Has that impacted your funding at all?
Not at all, no. eBay is increasingly important to us to get funding in. We don't need a lot of funding, but anything we make, we pay for stuff we use, like oils and sandpapers and that sort of thing to restore the tools. And then we send the rest of any money we make down to our headquarters.
Right. I mean, if people are thinking, well, I have got some tools, but I mean, they're pretty rusty and they're all just sort of sat at the back of the shed, looking a bit grotty. I mean, what sort of stuff are you in? What level of stuff are you interested in?
Right.
Can you fix stuff?
We are interested in any form of hand tools that you may have, and almost the older the better, because you can imagine, as I said earlier on, they haven't any power. So if you've got the old-fashioned hand tools, they're excellent, and they're often of very good quality. The tools are, in fact, better quality than people get nowadays. And one of the things we're very keen on is very high quality of tools we send down. So, for example, all the hammers we send, all of them, the handles are removed and we put new handles in them, because there could be a problem. So all of the tools we send are of very high quality. The saws, for example, they've got to be the old type of saws which you can sharpen yourself, not the modern throwaway saws, because they can't be sharpened.
Okay, well, that's an interesting thing that people might not have thought about. Can you sort of go out to people and pick up this stuff, or do they have to sort of...
Yeah, we can collect from people, and we operate on a Tuesday at Kingswood Museum in Tower Lane in Warmley, and the people can come out between about 9:30 and 4:30 and drop stuff off at the museum. But I can leave my details at the end of the programme, or a website you can get in touch with.
Okay. So have you been to any of these countries where the tools are being used?
I've only been to South Africa, where we don't send tools, but I've been to Kenya both times on holiday, and I would like very much to travel out to see the tools being used, but we get a good feedback from our headquarters on what sort of things is happening. And we have had a guy from Uganda came over to visit the UK, sponsored by the headquarters, and he came to see us at our museum at Kingswood and see how we operated, and we got a lot of information from him.
Okay. So what sort of interesting examples could you give us of how people's lives have benefited?
Right. The tools we collect, and I'll concentrate on tools rather than sewing machines, but we collect the tools, and for example, carpentry tools, we put into a kit, and the kit for six men consists of about 120 carpentry tools, a range of chisels, various sorts of drills, planes, saws, hammers, this sort of thing. Those guys, having been trained in using them to sharpen them and this sort of thing, look after them. They'll set up a little combine in their country, and they will make things like furniture and you know, general carpentry work, and they will make themselves a living from that. The thing about having these tools is that they're far better tools than they could ever possibly afford themselves. In fact, the feedback we're getting is that the tools are on sale in the local areas, are rather cheap Chinese stuff, which don't compare with the tools that we get donated, which in most cases are made in England or made in USA or made in Germany.
Okay.
Very high quality tools.
I don't know if it would be easy to say what tools do you accept or what tools do you not accept. I mean, what stuff are you not interested in receiving
that
people
is,
might think?
There is very little we're not interested in, but for example, we don't take things like computers or typewriters. That's the sort of thing which people do offer us, but we cannot use them. Garden tools we used to refuse, but we can now take them because one of our people at the headquarters, in fact, restores the garden tools down near Southampton, and he will set up and sell them at sort of car boots and this sort of thing. So yes, we can accept all sorts of tools, and including garden equipment as well, but not things like typewriters or computers.
Okay, I suppose metalwork tools might be a bit awkward because a lot of them might be electrical, I guess.
Electrical, we are taking them because some villages are, in fact, they've got generators or they're starting to get mains power. Rather intermittent, but yes, we can take them.
Okay. How can people get in contact with you or the organisation if
right.
they should?
Right. The organisation has a website, which is www.tfsr.org. The TFSR is Tools for Self-Reliance, so it's www.tfsr.org.
Okay.
Myself, I can give you a phone number. It's Rodney Stone, Rod Stone, on Bristol 937-3102. That's 937-3102.
Brilliant. Okey-doke. And I imagine, of course, if you can't remember any of that, if you put Tools for Self-Reliance into whatever search engine you use, that will come up anyway.
That'll come up, yeah.
That'll come up. Well, Rod Stone, time for a song now as an introduction to what follows. We've chosen Sunday Bloody Sunday, sung by U2, recorded in 1983. During its earliest performances, the song created some controversy, as you may imagine. Bono reasserted the song's anti-sectarian violence message to his audience for many years. The tune grew from a lyric written in 1982 by The Edge. Drummer Mullen said of the song in 1983, so this is his quote, and I won't do the Northern Ireland accent because that might be a bit disrespectful. "We're into the politics of the people. We're not into politics. Like you talk about Northern Ireland, Sunday Bloody Sunday, people sort of think, oh, that time when 13 Catholics were shot by British soldiers. That's not what the song is about. That's an incident, the most famous incident in Northern Ireland. But really, it's the strongest way of saying, how long? How long do we have to put up with this? I don't care who's who, Catholics, Protestants or whatever. You know, people are dying every single day through bitterness and hate. And we're saying, well, why? What's the point? You can move that into places like El Salvador and other similar situations with people dying. So let's forget about the politics. Let's stop shooting each other and sit around the table and talk about it. There are lots of bands taking sides saying politics is rubbish, etc. Well, so what? The real battle is people dying. That's the real battle. And that's what Mullen had to say about it. So here it is, and you can decide for yourself. We'll be right back. That was Sunday Bloody Sunday by U2, recorded in 1983. So, continuing with Northern Ireland, the thing for now, our next interview is with Brian Kennaway from near Belfast. Brian has written a book called Tradition Betrayed, and it's about the Orange Order in Northern Ireland. And here he talks to Dialect's Anthea Page about the Orange Men and the Bill of Rights.
March in spite of foe, as those mighty oceans roll. For we never will surrender in sunshine or in storm. It's our cause we'll defend it and guard it from all harm. When danger round us over.
Can you tell us how the Orange Men originated?
The Orange Men. This is the Loyal Orange Institution of Ireland, and Orange Men in general originated when Orange societies were formed in the south of England to welcome William and Mary at the time of what's commonly called the Glorious Revolution. They, of course, existed for a while during William and Mary's joint reign. They disappeared, but after the Battle of the Boyne, Orange societies were formed, and there are other names for them, like the Loyal Orange William Society or the Enniskillen Society, groups that fraternal groups which met to remember the battles of the Irish campaign.
Why was William of Orange invited to come to Britain in the first place?
Because James II was a bad king. He had converted to Catholicism. He was attempting with Louis, some of the Louis of France, I don't know which one, to impose Catholicism on England. Orange societies were formed to support William and Mary in their reign. After the Battle of the Boyne, other societies were formed in Ireland to remember the events in Ireland. And then in 1795, the Orange Order, or the Orange Society, was formed, which was, in fact, a conglomeration of all the various societies which existed. But it was sparked off because of the pressure on land in County Armagh. And a lot of Catholic folks from other parts of Ireland came into Armagh, taking up land, and Protestants felt as if they were being put out of the county. There's a little battle called the Battle of the Diamond, which was really a bit of a ruckus in which a few people were murdered, shot. But other than that, the Orange Association was formed after that. So the Loyal Orange Institution of Ireland can trace itself back to 1795, but Orangeism in general is much more widespread than the Orange Order.
People in Ireland see this as a predominantly English faction.
No, that aspect of the history has been largely forgotten about.
Why have they tried to ban marches by the Orange Men in the past? Has it caused problems?
Well, the British government banned parading in the past, not marching. I've never seen an Orange march in my life, because I've never seen two Orange Men keep in step. March, I usually think of the military marching, where they do keep in step.
Why do they parade the Orange Men in Ireland?
For various reasons, but chiefly it's to remember the Battle of the Boyne. They do so on the 12th of July every year, providing, of course, the 12th is not on a Sunday, otherwise they parade on a Monday. 12th of July is really the 1st of July, because the calendar changed, as you know, in 1752. The Battle of the Boyne was really on the 1st of July.
Why is the Battle of the Boyne so significant in Ireland?
Well, it was one of the final battles of the European campaign, whereby James II was trying to regain the throne and oust William and Mary. It wasn't the final one. The final one was the Battle of Aughrim a year later. But the Battle of the Boyne was the one that was the decisive one in many ways, because after that, James fled.
Is that really significant for a lot of Irish people then?
It should be significant for all Irish people, north and south, because it was part of the whole development of Western democracy and civil and religious liberty for all.
In what way? Can you explain that?
To live back in the 17th century, you only had a vote if you were a lord or a sir or something. You didn't have any sense of democracy at all. But the whole thing was overthrown by the Glorious Revolution and the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights of William and Mary, which was received by William and Mary, was provided by the Parliament. They received it and accepted it and promised to rule under the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights meant that the King could not impose taxes, only Parliament could. The King couldn't raise an army, only Parliament could. And that Parliaments had to be called. Now, it had to be called by what was the democracy of the day, which was not, of course, a universal franchise, but that was really the turning point of Western democracy and its whole impact in the British system of democracy.
Was that when the monarch lost all power of absolutism?
That was the beginning of the constitutional monarchy in William and Mary's reign.
Were many people killed in these battles in Ireland, and who fought against who?
William's army was made up of various regiments from Ireland, including the Enniskillens. He also had a Dutch regiment with him, the Dutch Blues. They were actually a Catholic regiment, although they fought for William. There were some Protestant regiments, of course, also that fought for James. So it's seen rather in simplistic terms by some people as Protestants fighting Catholics, but it wasn't just as simplistic as that.
What was the long-term effects of that battle?
Well, the long-term effects, I suppose, the cynic would say, we see it every year. There's a common joke told about William and James. After James was defeated at the Boyne and was made his way of escape through Dublin to Kinsale, where he fled to France and never to return. He was followed by William, but the story's told before James got that far, James and William met in a Dublin pub. And since they were father-in-law and son-in-law, they had a drink together. And James said to William, or William said to James, take it wherever you like, is, oh, sure, don't worry, there'll not be a word about this in a week or two.
What would have been the effect on Ireland had William of Orange lost the battle?
Well, the question is wrong, because not the effect in Ireland, the effect would have been on European democracy and in terms of the British monarchy, not just Ireland. If William had been defeated, you'd have been back to an intolerant regime of James II.
So do you think people in England were worried about having another civil war?
They may have been, but I don't think that was predominant thing in their minds. It would have been the fact that James II had converted to Catholicism, was raising an army of Catholics, which he was not entitled to do, even before William came, and was trying to overthrow the power of England and the liberties of England. Hence, of course, when William and Mary came, one of the great slogans was, the liberties of England we will maintain. So it was the maintenance of English liberties, which was the great question. But then, of course, at that time, the Pope was technically for William, which is interesting, a twist of history. The power, in some ways, of Orangeism has been greatly depleted over the years. Formed in 1795, the height would have been under maybe an old regime with the Irish Parliament in the early days, when most of the members of the old Irish Parliament, which was dissolved in 1801, were Orangemen. The power of the established church in Ireland waned with its disestablishment in 1870. So the Anglican Church is not established in Ireland. So all those kind of powers have somewhat dwindled away. There was a resurgence of power when the Northern Ireland Parliament came into existence in the 1920s, where most politicians were Orangemen. That, again, has waned. So the power and influence of the Orange Order has waned considerably.
Do you think it'll die out altogether eventually?
I think it will. A lot of fraternal societies are on the wane, Masons included. There are huge drops in number, certainly in Ireland. I don't know about the rest of the United Kingdom, but certainly in Ireland there is. Its influence has certainly gone considerably, and it'll hardly last another 100 years, I would have thought.
That was Brian Kettaway from near Belfast, Northern Ireland, talking about the Orange Order and the Bill of Rights. It's time once again for a weekly instalment of The Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, edited by Ernest McHugh and read by Alec Milne, himself a Scotsman. The music you hear is Duff, and that's performed by Concerto Caledonia.
The Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 10, The Cruise of the Casco, The Marquesas, Pomotos, Tahiti, July 1888 to January 1889. At 5 a.m. on the morning of the 28th of June 1888, the tug Pelican towed the Casco through the Golden Gate out of San Francisco Bay into the waters of the Pacific Ocean. After 22 days at sea and a voyage of 3,000 miles, the yacht dropped anchor on 20 July in Anaho Bay in Nuka Hiva, the largest of the Marquesas Islands. In the opening paragraph of In the South Seas, Stevenson later described the mood in which he set out. For nearly 10 years my health had been declining, and for some while before I set forth upon my voyage, I believed I was come to the afterpiece of life, and had only the nurse and undertaker to expect. It was suggested that I should try the South Seas, and I was not unwilling to visit like a ghost and be carried like a bale among scenes that had attracted me in youth and health. The Casco was a graceful, two-masted schooner yacht, 94 feet in length, of 74 tons burden. Captain Albert H. Otis began the voyage, in Balfour's words, with a supreme contempt for his new employers, and ended it as an intimate and valued friend. Ourless later drew his portrait in the wrecker as Captain Nares. In the last few letters written to his friends during this period, Stevenson made no attempt to provide a detailed account of his experiences. All his literary energies until he reached Tahiti were devoted to his journal, The Cruise of the Casco, which has never been fully published. From it he later quarried parts 1 and 2 of the South Sea Letters, syndicated by McClure in 1891 and posthumously published in 1896 as The South Seas. Unfortunately, RLS discontinued this journal when he reached Tahiti, and he never wrote the account of Tahiti he planned. Charles Baxter, 7 a.m, 6th September 1888, with a dreadful pen. Yacht Casco, at sea, near Port Matus. My dear Charles, last night as I lay under the blanket in the cockpit courting sleep, I had a comic seizure. There was nothing visible but the southern stars and the steersman there out in the binnacle lamp. We were all looking forward to a most deplorable landfall in the morning, praying God that we should fetch a tuft of palms which are to indicate the dangerous archipelago. And all of a sudden, I had a vision of Drummond Street. It came on me like a flash of lightning. I simply returned thither and into the past, and when I remembered all that I had hoped for and feared as I pickled about Rutherford's in the rain and the east wind, how I feared I should make a mere shipwreck, and timidly hoped not, how I feared I should never have a friend, far less a wife, and yet passionately hoped I might. How I hoped, if I did not take to drink, I should possibly write one little book, etc., etc., etc. And then, now, what a change! I feel somehow as if I should like the incident set upon a brass plate at the corner of the dreary thoroughfare for all students to read, poor devils, when their hearts are down. And I felt I must write one word to you. Excuse me if I write little. When I am at sea, it gives me a headache. When I am in port, I have a diary crying, give, give. I shall have a fine book of travels, I feel sure, and I will tell you more of the South Seas after a few months than any other writer has done, except Herman Melville, perhaps, who is a howling cheese. Good luck to you, God bless, your affectionate friend, RLS. On 24th October 1888, the Casco left Papeete and sailed round to Taravao on the south side of Tahiti on a dangerous and unpleasant journey whose worst moments were later recalled in a letter to Bob. They arrived on the 25th. The climate was unhealthy and RLS grew steadily worse. Fanny bravely determined to move him to the village of Totira, a difficult journey of some 16 miles through dense forests and across many streams. On 28 October, following an earlier journey of reconnaissance, she managed, with the help of Lloyd and Valentine, to get him there and to rent a suitable house. The day after RLS and Fanny had arrived in Totira, the Princess Mo, hearing that there was a sick foreigner in the village, whose wife was troubled because he would not eat, brought him a South Sea delicacy, a dish of raw fish with meaty sauce, coconut milk mixed with lime juice and seawater, which she had prepared herself. For the next few days, she continued to bring him or send him special dishes. Fanny later told Balfour, "I fear that she must have saved Louis's life. He was lying in a deep stupor when she first saw him, suffering from congestion of the lungs and in a burning fever." To Thomas Archer, 18 December 1888, Tortira, Island of Tahiti. Dear Tom Archer, this is a pretty state of things. 7 o'clock and no word of breakfast, and I was awake a good deal last night, for it was a full moon, and they made a great fire of coconut husks down by the sea, and, as we have no blinds or shutters, this kept my room very bright, and then the rats had a wedding or a school feast under my bed. And then I woke early, and I have nothing to read except Virgil's Aeneid, which is not good for an empty stomach, and a Latin dictionary, which is good for naught, and by some humorous accident my dear papa's article on Skerivore. And I read the whole of that, and very impudent it is. But you must not tell your dear papa I said so, or it might come to a battle in which you might lose either a dear papa or a valued correspondent, or both, which would be prodigal. So I said, let's write to Tom Archer. This is a much better place for children than I have seen hitherto in these seas. The girls, and perhaps the boys, play an elaborate kind of hopscotch. The boys play horses exactly as we do in Europe, and have very good fun on stilts trying to knock each other down, in which they do not often succeed. The children of all ages go to church, and are allowed to do what they please, running down the aisles, rolling balls, stealing Mama's bonnet, and publicly sitting on it, and at last going asleep in the middle of the floor. You are to imagine a four-wheeled gig, one horse, in the front seat, two Tahiti natives, in their Sunday clothes, blue coat, white shirt, kilt, a little longer than the Scotch, and a blue stuff with big white or yellow flowers, legs and feet bare. In the back seat, me and my wife. Under our feet, plenty of lunch and things. Among us, a great deal of fun in broken Tahitian, one of the servants, a sub-chief of the village, being a great ally of mine. Indeed, we have changed names, so that he is now called Rui, for they have no L and no S in their language. Rui is 6'3" in stockings, and a magnificent man. We all have straw hats, for the sun is strong. We drive between the sea, which makes a great noise, and the mountains. The road is cut through a forest mostly of fruit trees, the very creepers, which take the place of our ivy, heavy with great and delicious fruit, bigger than your head and far nicer, called berberine. Presently we came to a house, in a pretty garden, quite by itself, very nicely kept, and the doors and windows open. No one about, and no noise, but all that of the sea. It looked like a house in the fairy tale, and just beyond we must ford a river, and there we saw the inhabitants. Just in the mouth of the river, where it met the sea waves, they were ducking and bathing and screaming together like a covey of birds, 7 or 8 little naked brown boys and girls, as happy as the day is long, and on the banks of the stream beside them, real toys, toy ships fully rigged, and with their sails set, though they were lying in the dust on their beam ends. Then I knew for sure they were all children in fairy story, living alone together in that lonely house with the only toys on the island, and that I must have driven myself in my four-wheeled gig into a corner of the fairy story, and the question was, should I get out again? But it was all right. I guess it was one of the wheels of the gig that got into the fairy story. The next jolt, the whole thing vanished. We drove on in our seaside forest as before, and I have the honour to be Tom Archer's valued correspondent, Tortira, which is previously known as Robert Louis Stevenson.
Thanks there to Alec Milne for reading the 10th part of the select letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. There has been a delay in the recording of Treasure Island, read by Malcolm Grieve, but hopefully this will be with us by next month. So sorry to keep you waiting, but you will get it in time. It's a pleasure to introduce, again, a poet of the week, Tim Burrows. Hello.
Hi.
So how's your week been? What's on your mind?
Oh, I'm kind of busy, yes, but a good week. Big, you know, doing some writing, doing some music, usual things.
Okay, what have you got to offer this week?
Well, I've got a couple of poems, and they're both poems that look back to places of being. One's from looking back to Mexico, to Oaxaca. So I'll do that first. Mm-hmm. Looking back, returning to that courtyard of sun and shade, of dry heat and water, lounging in the shade under the stone parapet, inside the thick walls that make rooms cool. Rooms cool and safe, safe in the shadows, safe from the shadows in the street, with the cool splashing water, the water running down the circular fountain, centrepiece of the courtyard, deal amber space, the round circle enclosed by a square, a walled square of rooms, cool rooms with high ceilings, with a red-tiled roof terraced above. Above, looking down the dusty streets to the town square of light through leaves, speckled leaves of plane trees, giving shade to the street hawkers with their bright-coloured bloons and sweet-scented flowers, sweet-tasting pastries and breads, as tunes drift over from the bandstand, played by the mariachis with their leather trousers with studs and bright, shiny teeth showing through smiling lips as they sing the cucaracha, as we chink green-yellow glasses of ice margarita, as the pretty schoolgirl brings her bangles and toys to sell for tortillas for her family, back home in the little house down the streets, the dusty streets, as the sun sets through the mottled trees in the great plaza with its brightly dressed evening throngs as Oaxaca waits for night to come.
Thank you. What is the theme for your second one that you have?
The second one's written this summer in Porthleven in Cornwall, on the wonderful beach at Porthleven. The sea's the only sound as it pounds down the shingle with a muffled, ruffling, crunching crash, as the wave tip curls along the moving crest of a breaker. Moon movement of salt, sea salt blue, cold blue, with foamy white moving edges, as the bright white sun glares down, shining a mirror on the shifting deep turgid blue green blue, as it warms my skin, as I sit crossed yet legged, yogic on the undulating dipping trough, ocean of sand, necklaced with dry beige brown, dry kelp and wrack, shipwrecked on this Cornish shore.
Very beautiful place, Cornwall, and it's inspired an awful lot of writing and poetry. Do you, or are you, performing anytime soon? Can people see you live?
Yes, we're doing, the Bristol Poets are doing some poems with Diana Taylor's films, poetry films, at the Pyrian Centre on Tuesday the 5th of April at 7:30 till 10. Mm-hmm. Bar opens at 7, and it should be fun because Dice films are fantastic. And that's me, Trevor Carter, David Johnston, and Charles Thompson.
Excellent. Well, you get two poets from our show for the price of one if you get to that event. How about that? What better reason could you need to go? Tim Burrows, thank you very much. And what day is that again?
Tuesday the 5th.
Tuesday
April.
The 5th. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you to Tim. And what's on for next week? Jeff Sparks, over to you now.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Thursday, 24th of March, The Stranglers. We perform it with support from Wilco Johnson at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £23.50 in advance. On Friday, 25th of March, the police tribute group, The Undercover Police, will be performing at the Victoria, which is at 88 Victoria Road, Swindon. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £6 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present Airborne. This group hail from Australia and formed in 2003. To date, they have released two albums, and this is from the most recent album, No Guts, No Glory, and it's a track titled Raise the Flag. That was Airborne with the track Raise the Flag from the album No Guts, No Glory, which was released in 2010. For more information on them, check out www.airbornerock.com. Into Saturday, 26th of March, 45s will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. Finally, on Sunday, 27th of March, Stiff Little Fingers will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £14 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, thank you to Jeff and his Cradle of Filth t-shirt. Good stuff there. That's all from Dialect this week. Thank you to our studio guests, Vivian Kinston from Fairtrade and Rod Stone from Tools for Self-Reliance. Features were by Anthea Page and Alec Milne. Alec Milne also read the letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. The poem was by Tim Burrows and the Watson was by Jeff Sparks. The engineer was by Michael Noyce and I was the presenter, John Peters Golden. So, until next week, the producer was Anthea Page and thank you to you all. Goodbye.
All the people breathing. for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. Oh, you may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you will join us.